I'm Robin Young. Welcome to Here and Now. Well, a Wall Street Journal headline today put it best, warily we roll along. Lobbyists and lawmakers are tweaking the details in a revived rescue package, which, as you can just hear, came with a new name. The Senate has scheduled a vote this evening. The bill will reportedly include stronger protections for homeowners facing foreclosure, an increase in the amount of money in a bank that can be insured by the federal government, and new accounting rules that allow Wall Street executives to revise a stock's worth. Wall Street Journal reporter Greg Hitt is on Capitol Hill. Greg, same as the old bill with some new ideas?
You're exactly right. In the last day or two in the wake of the House vote.
Revolt.
Yes, exactly. You had the leaders come together around a handful of additions that they think will widen support. One of those is a proposal to increase the insurance limits for deposits in banks. Currently, they are set for individual accounts at $100,000, but they have not been raised in more than a decade. And so this bill that they're going to vote on tonight would raise that limit to $250,000. Runs on deposits has contributed to some of the weakness and led to the undermining, we're told, of IndyMac, which failed, of the Washington Mutual Bank, which failed. And so raising the limit, lawmakers hope, raising the amount of dollars that are protected, they hope, will send a signal to consumers that they should be more confident in their banks and not withdraw their deposits.
Not withdraw their money. Okay, and what about stronger protections for homeowners facing foreclosure? There was talk of people being able to restructure or refinance loans in the other bill. What does this new bill say?
Well, good question. I think that some of the details are still a little blurry, but they've taken some steps to try to give comfort to homeowners in distressed situations financially, that the government, as they buy mortgages out of the take mortgages out of the private sector and onto the government books, that government officials will have the flexibility to go in and adjust terms, renegotiate loans. What they want is to try to create a situation that in which the federal policymakers who are running or managing these mortgages can make adjustments that ease the financial burden on homeowners around the country.
So they want to be able to have some ability for homeowners to have mortgages that they can actually pay.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. We understand there's also a tax bill that the Senate passed last week, and some lawmakers want to attach to this revised bailout bill. It would include incentives for developing renewable energy. It would address the alternative minimum tax, which many people feel middle-class people are paying and shouldn't be paying. It was originally designed for wealthier people. But we understand Nancy Pelosi doesn't want this tax measure included in this bill. What's the thinking about including this tax measure?
Well, it, by all accounts, it's going to come out of the Senate tonight with that provision in it. So the House will face some choices about how to handle it. And I think in the past, certainly Pelosi, the Speaker Pelosi, has raised concerns about the bill, the fact that it is not fully paid for within the budget. That's an issue that's of great importance to centrist members of her caucus in the House.
Yeah.
But the politics of this larger bill may scramble that situation, and we'll just have to follow that as the day unfolds.
Right. And Greg, you're there on Capitol Hill. What's the mood there? What how does it feel to you?
I mean, I think certainly in the Senate, there's a feeling of that the Congress needs to pull together and make a bipartisan statement of support for the package and move it along. In the House, I think there's a bit more hand-wringing because nobody who's carrying this bill wants to see the sort of collapse they saw last Monday.
Wall Street Journal reporter Greg Hitt from Capitol Hill. Greg, thank you so much.
You bet.
Well, let's switch our view now, our focus, to tomorrow night's vice presidential candidates debate. Catherine Seeley writes in the New York Times, there hasn't been this much anticipation about the second string since Lloyd Benson and Dan Quayle met in 88. We're going to hear from Catherine about candidate Senator Biden. But first, to Alaska and a view of Sarah Palin. And as Nina Totenberg said on NPR earlier this week, There really is no way to sugarcoat this. A new poll from Pew finds that 51% of Americans now believe that Sarah Palin is unqualified for the job of vice president, up from 37% after the announcement of her appointment this summer. Pew's Andy Kohut writes that Palin may now be hurting John McCain's candidacy. Her rambling answers during interviews with CBS's Katie Couric have become a YouTube sensation. Here, Couric asks Palin about the Bush administration's proposed $700 billion bailout package.
Ultimately, what the bailout does is help those who are concerned about the health care reform that is needed to help shore up our economy, it's got to be all about job creation, too, shoring up our economy and putting it back on the right track. So health care reform and reducing taxes.
And she went on for almost a minute. Now, Sarah Palin still has fierce supporters. Conservative syndicated columnist Kathleen Parker writes that since she called for Palin to step down, she's been receiving hate mail, presumably from conservative Palin backers, saying that she, Parker, should have been aborted. Michael Carey is a columnist for the Anchorage Daily News. He joins us from Anchorage. Michael, first of all, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Kathleen Parker there, the conservative columnist, was a big supporter of Palin's before she called for her to step down. And we're also hearing from conservative columnist David Brooks, who writes that, like President Bush, Sarah Palin seems to compensate for her lack of experience with brashness and excessive decisiveness. Commentators like Charles Krauthammer, George Will, former Bush speechwriter David Frum, all saying Palin isn't ready for the White House. Do you think they're underestimating her?
Well, we're going to find out here on the debate Thursday night. Her performance so far has been very poor, and my own sense of it is that the people who have been her handlers have done a very poor job by trying to stuff her head full of facts and figures and not let her relax and be the person she is. But if she is the person she is, they'd see that the voters would see that essentially she's a suburban housewife.
Well, and many people are looking back at her debates from her governor's race there in Alaska, and she really impacted people in a very positive way, but she had her critics then as well. I mean, when it came to Alaska, a state she's born and raised in, did she have a better grasp of facts and details?
Well, I think that's clear, but also there were times in those debates when she was very general, and she was forced at some point. Her opponents, the Democrat and Independent, asked her how she would vote on certain issues, abortion for one, various schooling issues for others, conservative hot button issues. She said the right answers for the conservatives, but those were yes and no type questions.
Well, how are Alaskans reacting to her now? I mean, we know she was once the most popular governor in the country. How's her support in Alaska?
I think what's happened is something quite surprising and something most of the people in the media here couldn't imagine, her becoming a polarizing figure. As she's gone national and become more partisan, she's lost support here at home because she never was a partisan figure here at home. She was somebody who worked well with the Democrats and, in fact, had to have Democratic votes to pass the major pieces of legislation that she wanted.
She fought her own party.
Yes, that's correct.
And so this is a surprise to people?
I think it's very much a surprise to people, and it's a surprise to me, certainly, and I've covered her for several years, and it's particularly reflected in the polls where her approval has gone down from more than 80% to the high 60s. Now, most politicians would take the high 60s, but we don't know how long it might be, the 50s or the 40s or whatever it might fall to.
Well, and Mike, what do you think is at play here? Because you just said before that people are seeing her for what she really is, and maybe that is just as feisty and attractive as it is to people, a suburban housewife, of course. Apologies
and,
to
I'm
suburban
not
housewives.
To
right.
Suburban housewives.
Right, right. But what do you think is happening here? Is it a traditional storyline we're familiar with, a woman who's put up on a pedestal and then within minutes, becomes a pinata? People try to knock her down. Or is it really a sense that she took on more than she should have? Her response to Charlie Gibson when she was asked if she had all hesitated before accepting the nomination, she said no. Is it really a sense that maybe she's overstepped?
I think there's something that's been taught to me about in politics, and that is On the way up, you can get every break in the world and just get to the top very rapidly. On the way down, you don't get any breaks at all. And this isn't just a matter of breaks, however. It's a matter of people making up their mind based on information and impressions of whether they want this person to be vice president. Now, the people who are writing to Kathleen Parker, the columnist, and threatening her with death or whatever it is, those are people who have this kind of affinity for Sarah Palin. She is them. She represents them. These people feel so intensely about her that to insult Sarah Palin in any way is to insult them. But there just has to be a limit on how many of those people there are.
Well, and how much is what's being called Troopergate impacting how Alaskans are responding to all of this? And we'll remind people, a judge is set to hear arguments later this week on whether to halt this abuse of power investigation of Sarah Palin that she was initially in favor of, kind of had an attitude of bring it on. And the investigation centers on whether Palin tried to use her position as governor, along with her civilian husband, to fire a state trooper who was in a divorce and child custody battle with Palin's sister the year before. And this was all before Palin was chosen as the VP nominee. She said then, hold me accountable, but now no one involved on her staff has complied with subpoenas, and the McCain campaign is calling it a political witch hunt.
This is an example of the national campaign coming here and running the response to Troopergate. This is being run by people from Washington, D.C., who are strictly beholden to Senator McCain and the campaign. And their approach is scorched earth, take no prisoners, total war on the Democrats. And they've turned it into a partisan affair. And I think they're hoping that there will be no report on or outcome before the election, and that people back east, your listeners, will just say, gosh, I can't figure this out. There's some kind of mess up there in Alaska, but it's too much of a headache for me to figure out what's really going on.
It'll just go away. Well, we should say she still has tremendous support out on the campaign trail, really can wow people when she meets them in person.
With the right audience, she is terrific, and one-on-one, she can be just great. And I know that myself from running into her in the street.
Well, and as people do out there, and also Republicans here in the States. I mean, the chair of the party in Michigan says he expects Palin to show the country she's capable, articulate. The Republican chair in South Carolina says that...
I've read what all those chairmen have to say, and my response to their approach is, they talk about her talent, her ability, her knowledge. What they leave out is... And I'm really looking forward to meeting her. I don't think those guys have spent 15 minutes in a room with her and are qualified to say anything.
Which
I know that's blunt, but that's what I think.
Well, and you said that to us when she was first nominated, and many reporters in Alaska feel that way. But again, the Republican chair in South Carolina is saying he expects her to show that all these misapprehensions about Sarah Palin were a pylon by the media elite. Just one quick, very quick question, Mike Carey. Do you think she will step aside?
I can't imagine that it would be a disaster for her personally and a bigger disaster for John McCain.
Mike Carey, columnist for the Anchorage Daily News, speaking to us from there in Anchorage. Mike, we can see you from here.
Thank you.
We can't. Mike, thank you so much. And when we come back after a minute break, we're going to go on to the Democratic side of the ticket and take a look at Joe Biden, a veteran politician also known for some verbal missteps. I've had a few of my own today, I know, as well. Back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been taking a look at tomorrow's debate between the vice presidential nominees, the Republican Sarah Palin, and the Democratic candidate Joe Biden. And joining us now is Catherine Seeley. She writes about both candidates in today's New York Times and joins us from her office in Manhattan. Catherine Kitt, welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And just your thought about, you've done the research, you've observed Palin's debates in Alaska, you are watching her on the campaign trail now, what she's saying now. How do you think she's going to approach tomorrow night's debate?
Well, I think she's giving us a little clue right now on the campaign trail. She's been saying, oh, Senator Biden, I've been listening to him give speeches since I was in second grade. And this gets a big laugh, and I think it shows a couple of things. that she is going to use his age against him. She's portraying herself as energetic and open to new things and ready for change. And although he's not that old, he's 65, she's 44, I think, that she's going to try to portray him as sort of part of Washington. He's been in Washington almost four decades.
Well, a couple dangers there, because, first of all, her running mate is in his 70s.
Well, there you are.
Did she draw attention to that? but perhaps, you know, the benefit is, as you said, it points out that he has been around a while. And you write that Joe Biden has spent four decades in Washington. He's chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And so there is a lot out there that he's already said. Do you see that as a positive or a negative for Joe Biden?
Well, both. It's a positive in that he knows almost every issue inside out. He's got a lot of experience. He's worked overseas. He's met these foreign leaders whom Ms. Palin has not met. So that's very helpful. The downside of it is when you have a record that long, you have a lot of contradictory votes, a lot of contradictory positions.
For instance, you write a weakness that may come up tomorrow night is Biden's record of votes and how they may compare with Barack Obama's sentiments. During the primary debates, Biden was uncomfortable defending his vote for the 700-mile-long fence along the Mexican border that was built to keep illegal immigrants out of the country. And he's obviously going to have to defend his support for war funding, even though when he was running as a presidential candidate against Barack Obama, you know, they went back and forth over that.
It's a little awkward, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Palin has the same problem. She's got some differences with McCain. She is for drilling in Anwar, and John McCain is against it. She is opposed to stem cell research, and he is for it.
Yeah.
So she's got a couple of these things to explain also.
What about the criticism of Joe Biden that although he's very emotional and a lot of people out, you know, on the hustings are reacting to that, it doesn't go over as well in debates, and he also doesn't know often when to stop.
That's right. He's someone who can go too far, sort of a bridge too far. He can make an excellent point, and I think everyone saw it in the debate when he said, Rudy Giuliani does three things, a noun, a verb, and 9/11. And that got a huge laugh. But Biden didn't let it rest there. He strung out the joke, and I counted it because I was watching on the monitor, 43 more seconds. Giuliani had nothing to do with the question. The question was actually about Hillary Clinton.
You write about another instance during the CNN YouTube debate, again, when Biden was a presidential candidate, when someone sent in a video saying, I want to know if my babies are going to be all right. And the babies were this man's Bushmaster AR-15 automatic weapons. And Biden's response was, if that's his baby, he needs help. And the audience applauded that. But then Biden did what?
He said, you've self-incriminated because you bought this while it was under a ban. And then he said, I don't know that he's mentally qualified to own that gun, suggesting, I mean, this is not something you see every day, is a politician telling a voter basically he's mentally unstable.
Well, Joe Biden has also had his out-and-out gaffes. Let's listen to one. This is during an interview, again, with CBS's Katie Couric. And this is where Biden wanted to compare the current financial crisis with the stock market crash of 1929.
Part of what a leader does is to instill confidence, is demonstrate that he or she knows what they're talking about and communicates to people, if you listen to me and follow what I'm suggesting, we can fix this. When the stock market crashed, Franklin Roosevelt got on television and didn't just talk about the princes of greed. He said, look, here's what happened.
Of course, it was Hoover and there was no television.
Right.
But do you think he's going to be able to rein in tomorrow night?
That's the essential question about Joe Biden. Can he contain himself? And I think that he's really going to serious debate camp now. He's got Jennifer Granholm, another woman governor, to practice with, who's standing in for Sarah Palin. And I think they are really drilling this into him. I don't think he's ever had that before.
Huh.
So it may work. You know, it may also... You know, the inner Biden may still try to pop out.
Well, and just one last thing. He is, of course, debating a woman. Now, he's waved that off. He names all the women lawmakers that he's had to debate on a daily basis as a senator. But you remind us of when then-Vice President Bush was condescending or was seen as being condescending to Geraldine Ferraro in their debate. Biden has a challenge here.
It was kind of an excruciating moment. Bush won when he was vice president, was debating Jerry Ferraro, and said something like, "Let me help you with the difference, Mrs. Ferraro, between Iran and the embassy in Lebanon." And she very feistily picked up on that and highlighted that and underscored it and said, I almost resent your patronizing attitude. And I think Sarah Palin, if she sniffs anything that is at all sexist, patronizing, condescending, will be very quick to call him out on that.
Catherine Seeley of The New York Times. She has articles on both vice presidential candidates, back-to-back, great reading in today's New York Times. Catherine Kitt, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, should there be more ethics courses in business school? And what should they teach to avoid another bailout crisis? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, fact-checking the fact-check sites. That's after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And with just 33 days to go before the presidential election, the public airwaves are inundated.
Obama says Iran is a tiny country, doesn't pose a serious threat.
The Bush-McCain privatization plan, privatizing Social Security.
I will keep taxes low. My opponent will raise them.
We are bogged down in a war that John McCain now suggests might go on for another 100 years.
How to separate fact from spin. Well, this campaign season has spawned a lot of spin websites that claim to fact check the candidates. But how to fact check the fact checkers? For one thing, you can get Here and Now Media analyst John Carroll on the case. He's also a professor of mass communication at Boston University. He joins us in the studio. John, welcome.
Nice to be here, Robin.
And once there was just the urban legend website, that's Snopes.com. They're still fact checking myths. Then came the granddad of the fact check sites. This is factcheck.org out of the Annenberg Center at the University of Pennsylvania. What impact did factcheck.org have on all these, spawning all these other sites?
Kathleen Hall Jameson of the Annenberg Center was really one of the pioneers in the effort to deconstruct these ads, to take them apart, both the verbal part and the visual part as well, to try to let people know what the ads were doing. And she had a technique, I think she called it distancing, which was basically you put it in a box so that you don't reproduce the effects that the ad has when it's running as an ad. So in news coverage, what you try to do is separate out the ad, take it out of its normal context and its normal position in broadcast, and try to have people examine it in a different way. This spawned a whole series of ad watches on television and in newspapers, and it was very very much the rage in the 90s and into the early 2000s.
How do you know if the fact checkers aren't spinning for their own purposes?
I think you can cross-check the fact checkers all you want. Basically, you arrive at sources. It's the same as online journalism in general. You arrive at sources that you feel comfortable with, that you feel are credible, and that you feel are providing reliable information. But it's almost entirely arbitrary what they choose to fact check and what they don't choose to fact check.
Right. And here's some things they've looked at recently. Whether Obama's ad about McCain's stem cell policy is wrong, they say it's wrong. This is factcheck.org, says the Obama radio ad is wrong. McCain still supports federal funding for stem cell research. On the other hand, they note that a McCain-Palin ad claims the Obama-Biden ticket opposes clean coal. Factcheck.org says that's not true.
Right, but Joe Biden said they opposed clean coal. He misspoke. So technically it's true, and that's the problem with a lot of these sites, is that they have this sort of Talmudic approach to fact-checking, and it's all about technicalities, it's all about splitting hairs, and you can say, well, technically it's accurate, it may be accurate, but it's not true.
Well, let's get some of the new sites. There's something called SpinSpotter.com. Here's how they promote themselves on their website.
66% of Americans believe the news media is one-sided. Yet only 9% of journalists are concerned about their declining credibility. So that's our mission, to surface the spin in news, whip the media circus back in shape.
Okay, spinspotter.com. We've been trying to use this, but its creator admits it's very much in the testing phase, and it's a little rough right now. But basically, what are they doing?
Spinocular is a software program that tries to be what P.T. Barnum called the humbug-o-meter. P.T. Barnum thought everybody should have a humbug-o-meter so that they could detect this kind of spin. And they're trying to do it on a cyber level. And it doesn't seem to work. We haven't had any luck. But
the technology is kind of rough, but they say that they have an advisory board of journalists, and they came up with 6 transgressions based on the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics that they claim that their software will be able to spot in printed articles.
Right. These are things like passive voice, biased sources. These are things that are classic techniques of any kind of political discourse at all, campaign discourse anyway. And I think that it's fine to go out and try to detect them, but a lot of it is in the eye of the beholder. So I'm not sure actually how much this is contributing to the conversation.
Well, let's get to a little bit of that, because we spoke with Sam Wong. He's professor of biology and neuroscience at Princeton and also author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys and Never Forget to Drive, and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. But he did a study about how when our brain receives information, it can ultimately, over time, forget that it received that information from an unreliable source and just retain the information. And even telling people that the information is not true doesn't stick.
Right. Either it makes people resistant to those messages because of ideological or partisan reasons, or it just sticks in your brain as a piece of information that you got and you forget the context that you got it in. There's a new study that just came out, a Duke Georgia State study, that found very much the same thing. It found two things. One, that lies work, and two, that truth is not an antidote to lies. So there was a classic situation on 60 Minutes where Steve Croft was interviewing a voter in Ohio who said he thought that Barack Obama was a Muslim. And Steve Croft said, no, he's not a Muslim. He's a Christian. And the voter said, I think he's a Muslim. So in a way, it's what you adopt as your version of the truth. And the campaigns are very good at manipulating that. They are creating sort of these parallel realities that voters are buying, and all the fact-checking in the world isn't going to dismantle.
And by the way, we're well aware, we just did it again, because the words that some of our listeners might have heard that you just spoke were, Barack Obama is a Muslim, even if you went on to counter that with he is not, he's a Christian. And we have other websites as well. We have liecount.com, which we've got up over on another screen here. It's sort of they got a donkey with the number 10 and an elephant with the number 21. Those are the lies that they're tracking from each of the campaign. John Carroll, that brings me to something else. Have you ever heard the word lie used so openly in a campaign?
Yeah, I think news coverage in general has more qualifiers than Wimbledon. But basically, this time around, we're seeing an unequivocal language at this point that I find sort of remarkable, because for two reasons. One is news coverage normally doesn't do that.
And candidates don't do it either.
And candidates tend not to do it, but they're doing it as well. The second remarkable thing is it doesn't seem to have any effect at all. It doesn't seem to have any effect on the voters, at least not yet, and it absolutely doesn't have any effect on the candidates. They are not changing anything they're saying because of news coverage saying that it's false or misleading or inaccurate or a lie or whatever it may be. They're just plowing ahead. And I think that that's reflective of the state of the news media. The news media are more of a presence, but less of a factor this time around. Partly because there is just so much media out there that every voice has less of a share of voice. But the other part is that the news media are a self-cleaning oven. They cook it up, they serve it up, they clean up, they move on to the next story. There's a 16-hour news cycle that doesn't really allow anything to have any impact anymore. So it seems that all these stories, big stories coming out of traditional media, smaller stories coming, enterprise stories coming out of new media, all of them have their moment in the sun. They pass on, and nothing really seems to stick this time around.
Well, if you're a voter who would like to know a little bit more about what is true, if you're one of those that's left, we'll have the fact-check websites at ours, here-now.org. John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now, and also a professor of mass communication at Boston University. Thanks so much for dropping in.
My pleasure, Robin.
And while you're at the website, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address again, letters@here-now.org. Or you can always give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. We listen every call, read every email. Please continue to be our fact checkers. Thanks very much. Before we go today, Patty Larkin, you're listening to Here and Now. Well, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about one-third of all men and women and about 16% of children in the U.S. are obese, putting them at risk for a wide range of diseases and health problems. Researchers at the University of Wyoming are trying to find out why so many Americans are obese. They're looking at the link between the diets of pregnant females and the health of their offspring, and their subjects are sheep. Wyoming Public Radio's Addie Goss explains.
It was way back during World War II when scientists discovered that how a mother eats while she's pregnant affects the body weight of her children. Scientists studied a group of pregnant women who survived the 1944 famine under Nazi occupation of the Netherlands. Those women gave birth, not surprisingly, to very thin babies. But there was a dramatic change when those babies grew up. Many of them got fat and developed diabetes. More than 50 years later, Steve Ford at the University of Wyoming and Dr. Peter Nathaniels at the University of Texas decided to replicate the Dutch study in sheep. Why sheep? Ford says they're big. You can look at individual organs and learn what's going wrong.
We're able to actually get almost a complete story when we're talking about sheep.
So in 2001, they put a flock of female sheep on a really extreme diet, cutting their food by half. These undernourished mothers gave birth, and their lambs are now middle-aged sheep in a barn here at UW's Animal Science Livestock Research Center. Ford says when they were born, the sheep were abnormally hungry, and now, just like the Dutch children, they're getting fat.
And so we've been following them through their lifespan to see if, as they age, some of these symptoms, such as type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, start showing up.
And today, they're looking at the sheep's susceptibility to diabetes.
5 seconds for 27 minutes.
UW graduate students are doing what's called a glucose tolerance test. Lindsay George gives a sheep some sugar, then she draws the sheep's blood every minute.
And then I take the sample and put it into one of these blood collection tubes that prevents clotting.
George is measuring how quickly the sugar they fed the sheep disappears from its blood. In a normal body, our muscles and fat use the hormone insulin to slowly take sugar out of the blood and use it. But Ford's team is finding that long after these sheep eat, their blood sugar levels, also called glucose levels, stay high.
And that glucose then floats in the bloodstream, and much of that is then deposited as fat.
So why is this happening? Ford says lambs that were starved in the womb have less muscle than normal, and since muscle is responsible for taking the majority of sugar out of the blood, too little muscle and the sugar keeps floating around. This problem is called insulin resistance. In humans, it almost always leads to type 2 diabetes, and Ford says the fact that undernourished animals are insulin resistant so often helps shed light on a human phenomenon.
We can kind of relate this back to individuals from third world countries that come to the United States and are subjected to our fast food industry or to the increased amounts of nutrition. They tend to develop type 2 diabetes at much higher rates than individuals who were actually born in this country.
Ford began to wonder, if skinny sheep have babies with type 2 diabetes, how about fat sheep?
Sheep are kind of like people. They don't seem to have any common sense about feed intake. So we have to be careful not to get them to eat too much because then they have trouble even getting up.
When those fat sheep got pregnant, their fetuses were huge, about a third heavier than normal. Their hearts were bigger and their pancreases, the organ that produces insulin, were three times normal size.
The pancreas was developing prematurely and becoming much larger.
That's bad news for the pancreas.
If we prematurely cause development of the pancreas, it might fail later in the life of the animal or prematurely fail.
And if the pancreas fails, the animal can develop type 2 diabetes, which led Ford to a pretty amazing conclusion.
The symptoms that we see in these lambs from obese mothers are very similar to what we see with the sheep that were undernourished.
Both groups are fatter than average, hungrier than average, and often insulin resistant. Now Ford is planning to breed sheep with specific parts of their diet altered. Less protein, less fats, less carbs. The goal is to figure out exactly what pregnant women should eat to ensure the optimal health of their baby. And if the team is successful, we Americans will owe a lot to these sheep.
So thank you. That report from Wyoming Public Radio's Addie Goss. Coming up, from bouzouki to banjo, Patty Larkin plays them all and then engineers them all on a new CD. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
In the gray mist, with beautiful silence, you walk in the gray mist of happiness.
That's Patty Larkin's raga-infused song Phone Message, all Indian stylings and a bouzouki. But as one reviewer said, in the very next cut on Patty's new CD, she's all meat and potatoes singer-songwriter fare, and that's a good thing. Watch the Sky is Patty Larkin's 11th CD in 22 years. She doesn't just play the guitar, she climbs inside it, and she's brought one of the many instruments she plays with her here to our studios for a listen. Patty, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You're known for successful collaborations with other musicians, but this you did all yourself?
Yeah, it's kind of a scary thought. I just found myself with the gear in my house and
out of Cape Cod,
yeah, and more familiar than ever with it, and writing and recording as I went along, and so it kind of evolved that way.
And playing instruments from the guitar to lap steel to banjo, we mentioned the bouzouki. You produced, engineered, edited. Let's listen, because you also invented an instrument. I want to hear your slap steel. This is on Hallelujah. Let's listen to it a little.
Hallelujah, baby, I'm falling for you.
So what's the slap steel?
Well, you know, I wish I could take credit, but really, Ben Whitman, a wonderful percussionist drummer who lived in the Boston area for many years, he took a lap steel guitar and he detuned it to it was sort of like a thwop sound, but still kind of in the key, the right key, and then we ran it through an amp with a little delay on it, and he used his hands and a pencil and a mallet and got all different kinds of sounds out of that thing.
What'd you use on it?
That I did with my hands.
We end up in a world of wonder, wondering why everything looks so good. Hallelujah, babe, I'm falling for you. Hallelujah.
Well, there's that, you know, these highly produced wild sounds, but also what Boston Globe reviewer Joan Anderman called the meat and potatoes. And I want to say she followed that by saying that one song in particular, Cover Me, what she meant by meat and potatoes is that it was simple and lovely. Mm. I know you have your guitar here. Can we hear a little of Cover Me?
Oh, I'd love to play it.
I'm gone where no man has been. So cover me, cover me, I'm going in.
You know, I love that idea. I'm going in. Cover mm-hmm. me. What, I mean, what inspired it? What?
I don't know. I mean, I wrote some of the songs in sort of my more traditional style of writing, which was, you know, just sit with the guitar and see what comes out. And, you know, I think I've always used that as a little joke, like, cover me, you know, like, I'm going in. But that one, I wrote several songs in a very low, detuned tuning. It's usually I play that tuning in at D, starting with a D in the bass, and this one goes down to a B. So it kind of is inspiring in a way, just to kind of get those Nick Drake tones out of the instrument.
Nick Drake, of course, great late singer from England. Speaking of, you know, hearing other voices in yours, I was listening to All Souls Day, and I'm thinking, what am I hearing? What am I hearing here? And then I read John Perella's review in the New York Times praising All Souls Day for its vocal infused with Joni Mitchell's pearly depth. That's nice.
I'll take it.
How you found me here. How you found me. On a day like this.
It's Patty Larkin's All Souls Day from her new CD, Watch the Sky. And I'm wondering, Patty, you have another song that we just want to hear a little of. It's very different from the rest. It's called Hollywood.
They went to Hollywood. Would have gone to heaven.
You know, I'm wondering, here you are in Boston, you've had 11 music awards here, the mayor proclaimed Patty Larkin Appreciation Day. Why didn't you ever go to Hollywood? Is this cautionary song part of that?
Some songwriters did. I mean, obviously, Joni Mitchell lived out in L.A., and that whole songwriter scene out there, you know, Hotel California kind of thing. But anyway, I'm from the Midwest originally, and I know that... I moved out here.
Where in the Midwest?
In the 70s. Wisconsin.
Ah.
When I moved here, there was something about being able to study so many different kinds of music that it was walkable and doable to be in Cambridge and study jazz at Berkeley or study with somebody else across town, and but then go play street music and, you know, play Celtic music and go to a folk festival or whatnot. And I think there's something wonderful about that, and I always feel that Hollywood is just a flight away.
Traveling alone is a wonderful thing. Traveling alone is a wonderful thing.
Patty Larkin's Traveling Alone, about life on the road. But you write most of your music in your studio on Cape Cod. For instance, your song Beautiful. Now, do I understand you wrote that as you were recording it?
Yeah, the fun thing about the technology, the way it stands right now, is that I have the computer with all these snippets of songs and instrumental pieces that I could go back through and say, well, can I use that? And that slide part of Beautiful is something that I'd had for a couple years. And so I just started playing it, and I put the mic right in front of me watching the screen go by. And I think that that was the big difference for me in this, in writing and performing of this album, the recording of this album.
Wait, when you say this, watching the screen go by, you're talking about the computer screen. You're seeing your voice wave right in front of you.
Yeah, and I've always been a visual songwriter, but this is a whole new dimension to the writing for me, that because I was alone, without anyone looking over my shoulder or even judging it as it came down, I was able to just sort of jam, you know, do like my own little poetry slam there.
It was June. Maybe not.
Patty Larkin, we leave you with the song she's going to play for us here in the studio. This is Waterside. Thanks so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Robin. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Out in the bay, you can wash away in the morning time. You can see for miles over water wild with the naked eye. But when the tide comes in and it calls your name, there's nowhere to hide. Please remember me standing by the waterside. Please remember me when the moon is high. Please remember me standing by the waterside.
inside. And when you talk of forget-me-nots and Orion's right, please remember me standing by the waterside. Remember me when the moon is high. Please remember me standing by the waterside. And when you talk of forget-me-nots and Orion's right, please remember me standing by the waterside. And when you talk of forget-me-nots and Orion's right, please remember me standing by the waterside.